ESPN just made their announcement on a variety of different things regarding the app, and I know you discussed Katie Nolan. You've had Katie on your program, your podcast. What do you think of the announcement for what we were just talking about this in the previous segment, for having her do the once-a-week show that will only be available on the app? Do you think that is a good move for ESPN? Do you think it's a good move for Katie?
Well, in terms of Katie, I mean, I'm sure the check's clear no matter if she's on linear television or digital television, so that's fine for her. It's a good question. I mean, I would not expect this to be some kind of, you know, mega game-changing program. That said, what ESPN has to do as they head forward is they have to figure out programming that captures the attention of their, ultimately, what is going to be their large streaming audience, their digital audience. They have to think not just like what appears on ESPN, ESPN2, et cetera, but what's going to appear for their app, what's going to appear for their ESPN Plus service. So in that sense, you got a pretty high-profile person. You paid her a lot of money, and she clearly wants to helm her own show. So you figure out where the best possible place for that could be. The question is, like everything else, is there enough are there enough people who are going to watch her, at least at this time? I think, obviously, ESPN streaming service, ESPN Plus, as we head forward over the years, will get more popular, get more audience. At this point, though, those numbers are going to be very small. But if you're Katie Nolan, I think it's probably a good risk. You know, you want to be at the beginning of stuff as opposed to the end. And I don't think she's going to be able to get her own show on ESPN late night, given that Van Pelt pretty much has that slot tied up. Mm-hmm. So if you're her, you know, you already have a big contract. They're paying you anyway. I think it's not a bad bet.
Isn't ESPN and its interest in getting its streaming stuff together and expanding, isn't that what the purchase of the Fox regionals, isn't that part of that plan?
Absolutely. It's to get more. That deal gets them a lot more programming and a lot more live rights assets, which you know, if you sort of extrapolate, would make their streaming service that much more valuable if they're able to put live games from across the country on there. So, and again, we'll see if this happens, but in theory, you know, if I live in New York and ESPN has the Fox Regional, what used to be the Fox Regional in Houston, and I can get an Astros game that I might normally not get, if I subscribe to ESPN Plus, in theory, that makes ESPN Plus more valuable. So yeah, that's certainly part of it. I think audience and scale is part of it, because you can, you know, you can go to the advertisers and make the pitch that you have all these people or all these audiences watching your different networks and platforms, and in theory can get more money for that. But yeah, absolutely. The deal with Fox's regionals, if it ever goes through, I think far and away the most important part of that that deal is their streaming services, ESPN Plus.
Richard Deitch, our guest right now here on the Ryan Kelly Morning After, joining us on the Appliance Discounter phone lines. You can read him at theathletic.com, and then, of course, his sports media podcast, Doris Burke, the guest this week. You and Jim Miller on your podcast, Richard, for the last, God, I feel like year, have been talking about just not really buying in that GetUp is going to be successful. And based on the first month's numbers, you guys hit that thing on the head. And this ties into our Katie Nolan discussion. I feel like Katie Nolan would have been perfect on that show. I would have been more apt myself personally, I can only speak for myself, to tune in to see her there, and perhaps more so than Mike Greenberg and Jalen Rose, who I don't think necessarily move needles as far as waking up and going, oh, I can't wait to hear what Mike Greenberg thought of last night's game. Although I do realize this project was built around Greenberg. Was Katie ever involved in the potential to be on Get Up?
Hey, by the way, it feels like I've been talking about Get Up since 1737, actually, right before the revolution. I think she was, I mean, I think they considered her to be part of that ensemble. I don't honestly know how far those talks progressed. You know, Michelle Beadle, obviously, who got the job, was certainly somebody they were targeting. Carissa Thompson early on from Fox was somebody they were targeting. But I did hear that, you know, she and or her representatives did talk to ESPN about being on that show. You know, I think you hit it on the head. The problem is that morning show was never going to be a Katie Nolan vehicle. And listen, I like Katie. I think she's talented. But let's just be totally blunt. For ESPN decision makers, Katie Nolan doesn't have any kind of track record on linear television that suggests that, you know, 500,000, 700,000 people are going to watch her every morning if you base it on her numbers on FS1 on garbage time. So that would be, it would be very hard, I think, for, or maybe not hard is the right term. It would be a leap of faith for ESPN management to sort of center a show around her. All that said, your take on Mike Greenberg is my take on Mike Greenberg, and it's no disrespect to him. He's had a great career, obviously, won a million career. Quality broadcaster, can get you from A to B, certainly is prepared. But for a morning show in the most competitive television environment that exists, because it's not just sports, but you're dealing against the cable news channels, dealing against Today Show, GMA, CBS morning show. In my opinion, the only potential chance you have of creating some kind of non-sports center morning show is you have to have somebody that I want to wake up and hear from commenting on the previous day's events or the sports events. And Mike Greenberg is not that person. And I think Miller and I probably both agreed on that. He's a conventional broadcaster who certainly can be entertaining or interesting enough, but not to the point where I think it's destination viewing or listening where you want to hear what his opinion is on what happened the night before. He's just never been that broadcaster. I don't honestly know if there's a person in the ESPN stable who is that broadcaster, mm-hmm. or maybe anybody else in sports television, with the exception of somebody like Charles Barkley, although I don't think even Charles Barkley would be a destination 5 days a week. That's where I think the problem is with the show is I think their only shot, and I honestly don't think they have a shot, but to me their only shot would have been to be the ultimate news-making program where they every morning get like the guests of guests who can make news because they just happen to appear on that show. You know, in the way, it's not the best example, but once upon a time in this country, the Tonight Show basically could get anybody it wanted under Carson, and the fact if like that person just was a guest, they would make news almost by the sake of them being there. That to me would be the only way Get Up could really sort of succeed and blow up, is if just like the next day they had the person in sports who you absolutely wanted to hear from.
As a show that we admit is at the bottom of the sports talk food chain, we have nothing but respect for Mike Francesa and what he's been able to accomplish in his career. But the coverage of the Francesa return seems a bit over the top. What is your take on the way this story has been covered?
Seems a bit over the top. I mean, I live in New York. You cannot avoid Mike Francesa talk. I was with Parcells. We were talking about some game planning, and the great thing about Mike Francesa is, I mean, he's got a gigantic ego, and he does know famous people, but he loves to sort of place himself in situations which seem unrealistic. You know, like Obama and I were talking about the strike right before on Bin Laden, I gave him a couple of pieces of advice, and then we moved on. That's a very bad Francesa.
Well, we understood it. It was okay.
Really, I mean, in all honesty, that's not even open mic material, by the way, for a comedy show.
Fits in with this show, so thank you.
There you go. Yeah. Well, I'm giving you what you're paying me. Zero.
Okay.
Oh, my.
Yes. So, I answer your question sort of in the New York bubble, so it's a little tougher for me to have some perspective on this, but he's a guy who was the central figure in sports radio in New York City for 30 years. And he was part of, you know, arguably the most famous sports talk show of all time nationally, which is Mike and the Mad Dog. And a lot of that is because they were sort of at the beginning of this, and they were in the biggest market. And, you know, they sort of created a lot of things that had not existed before. I think, reason for this oversaturation is, one, I think Francesa, for nature of his fame, his sort of being able to be caricatured, he draws a lot of page views. And that's why I think you see a lot of this coverage. And then secondly, you know, if you just sort of take it on its face, it's kind of a crazy story. He spent 19 months essentially on a goodbye tour at WFAN, where they feted him for months and months, and callers, you know, seemingly like the show every day was basically people saying how great he was, or just, you know, how much they were going to miss him. So he did the whole, like, you know, the king gives up the crown kind of thing. And then 4 months later, he comes back, he blows out the people who had taken over his show, and, you know, he returns as if nothing ever happened. So it's just, you know, for less money. So it's a kind of a crazy media story in that you had a very big figure in sports media leave what seemed like on his own accord, thinking, I think, that he was going to get a lot of offers elsewhere. They didn't come. And then he goes back to his old station, goes back at less of a price. And then to sort of add the intrigue, he blows up, essentially by his coming back, this brand new show that the radio station had promoted and put in there. So in New York, at least, it's an absolutely crazy sports media story. In terms of nationally, while you guys may be interested, you know, you've just seen these crazy videos. The guy falls asleep, the guy screaming about something. You know, he's sort of just, he's a little bit of fodder for national people in the sense that he sort of represents at times kind of the most egotistical of New York City.
Yeah, that's kind of what we like. And those are usually the guys that kind of make it really big, aren't they? I mean, some of them never get anywhere, but if you can get past that, if you know something and you're still that much of a character, that's probably his secret to his great success.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think you guys know this part of sports talk radio to be successful, certainly in big markets, is you have to have hubris. You got to have an ego. You know, ideally, I would hope that you have sort of the knowledge and you're doing the work. And for a long time, Francesa actually did that. I would never discount his ability, his sort of knowledge of New York City sports was really, really great. And he followed everything. The show itself now is a little more of very much centered on the Yankees and the Mets and sometimes a little bit too much like Old Man Yells at a Cloud. But, you know, when you guys know this too, when you have somebody in a market for a long time, so this could be like a St. Louis television, sports television anchor. In New York's case, it's this radio icon. You know, a lot of times it's not even about performance anymore. It's just the behavior for people who just want to know that that person is around can keep that person in the chair. Like on a pure, like, how do I sort of phrase this? If I was evaluating the Francesa show right now as a sports radio show, I would call it kind of an average show at best. The reason why it raises far above that is because people feel comfortable knowing that at 3 o'clock they can turn on this radio station and they've heard a voice that they've heard for the last 30 years. So the best thing he has going for him now is sort of the familiarity and the comfortability that he brings.
There are people like that all over the country, even in local TV news. You go to a different city and you see some old guy or older woman and you go, what in the world is happening here? And yet they're the most popular person in town. Couldn't work anywhere else, but they're just killing it in the town that they're in.
You make a great point. It's not as much in New York anymore. It used to be. But, you know, I lived in Buffalo for 6 years. And I remember, this was in the late 90s, and I remember there was a guy on Buffalo television. Not too long ago when I was in Toronto, I turned on Buffalo TV. The guy was still there. He was not good when he was young, and he's certainly far worse. I'm not going to mention the guy's name now that he's older. But you are correct. My sense is that stations must do marketing or polling. And I think people at a certain point, if you can stay in a market, they just become really comfortable with you. And in my opinion, it's not about performance at all or merit. It's just about that sort of comfortability factor. And people, like, I think maybe just we as human beings like patterns. And we like the same thing a lot of times over and over again. But you're right. Where it really gets, like, absurd is when you have, like, the 63-year-old dude – like now partnering up with the 22-year-old like woman, you know, first job out of college. That's always like a tried and true like television programmer move in a lot of parts of the country, which again always seems like just rather silly.
A lot of anchor teams look like second marriages, like the guy left his wife for the younger girl.
Or they look like grandpa and his granddaughter about to head out fishing or something.
Right. Exactly. Right.
Hey, Richard, your podcast guest this week, Doris Burke, and a really good interview. I think the world of her, and I enjoyed the conversation, and she was really kind of candid to be, I think that might even be a euphemism in this case, because there was a great deal of candor regarding what her future is, her contract is up. What is your assessment of that situation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, for somebody who's so accomplished and I think has and enjoys the respect of most intelligent NBA fans, you know, she still remains pretty insecure about her place in broadcasting, which is, which is kind of remarkable. It, not necessarily that she's insecure about her ability to convey what she sees on the court to people, but just sort of her standing or place in broadcasting, which is kind of amazing. You know, she said a lot of that has to do with just the broadcasting business in general. You know, you work under contracts as opposed to sort of a salaried or at-will employee. But that still kind of was amazing to me. Her contract's coming up October 31st. She does think ESPN's going to re-sign her. I mean, they'd obviously be insane not to. But it was just interesting to hear somebody at that level, you know, talk about the insecurities of contracts. To me, it makes Doris kind of a real person, you know, that she would sort of go to that place where I think you have a lot of times people who are that famous in sports broadcasting sort of provide you with a lot of bravado. But she's excellent. She's grinded for a long time, worked her way up from very low-level men's college basketball games to the WNBA, to women's college basketball, to sideline reporting, obviously, on the NBA. And now this year did a full season of NBA games. I think she's excellent, and I think her biggest legacy will be that she and people like Kara Lawson, Sarah Kustak, who's full-time for the Nets, these women are have now changed the paradigm in sports broadcasting that you cannot put a woman in the analyst chair in the NBA if they know their stuff. And that means that there are going to be women behind these guys who ultimately get these jobs. And that's really good because you want the best people calling the games. We're never going to see that, I think, in the NFL. I don't think you're ever going to see a woman who works as an analyst. It's a shame because I'm sure there are probably women out there who are better than some of the analysts. But I don't see the NFL and its sort of masculine, hyper-masculine game doing that. We have seen, at least on the play-by-play end, Beth Mowins got in there. And I think, again, she's going to be someone who's going to be a pioneer. So maybe 20, 25 years later, maybe we have three women calling NFL games regularly as opposed to right now Beth Mowins. But that to me is what I think Doris Burke's legacy is. I think she just she blew out the whole notion of gender in that specific position. And now I think if you are just an excellent analyst of basketball, which she obviously is, I think now networks in particular, it's not going to be just about gender. It's just going to be DNA stuff.
Richard Deitch, you can read him at theathletic.com and listen to that podcast. I enjoy it every week, the Sports Media Podcast with
Thank
Richard
you.
Deitch. Always enjoy having you on the show, sir. Thanks so much. Have a great weekend, Richard.
Same to you guys. Appreciate it.